from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Most Americans will know Terry Jones best as a founding member of the British comedy troupe Monty Python's Flying Circus, as director of the films Monty Python and the Holy Grail, The Life of Brian, Monty Python's The Meaning of Life, and more. The Oxford-educated Mr. Jones is also a scholar of things medieval and author of several books on the Middle Ages, his latest speculating on the murder of the great poet Chaucer. But more recently, the former Python's attention has turned to the politics and the absurdities and outrages of the post-9/11 age. He's taken sharp satirical aim at George W. Bush and his own country's Tony Blair in a series of essays published in British papers over the past 3 years. His brutally funny observations have now been published in a new book, Terry Jones's War on the War on Terror. There's a bitter clarity here and a comic's sense of tragedy. Tonight on Point, Monty Python's Terry Jones on politics in the White House and Downing Street and in our own backyards. Joining me now from London is Terry Jones. His new book is Terry Jones's War on the War on Terror, Observations and Denunciations by a Founding Member of Monty Python. Terry Jones, good evening. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Hi there, Tom. Nice to be here.
Wonderful.
Well, nice to be in London.
Transatlantically here, and it's great to have you with us. You've got such a background that so many Americans will know a lot about from your Monty Python work in particular. But here you are all these years later. And you really have gone to war. You're not kidding. You've marshaled all your resources of humor and outrage, and you're gunning for these guys, Blair and Bush.
I think that's why they came back. Because I really don't. You know, I'm not a politician. I'm not a political observer or commentator. Really, it was just outrage at the obviousness of what's going on. And it's really like the Emperor's New Clothes. You know, you don't have to be. You know, in the story of the Emperor's New Clothes, It's the child who says what everybody else knows. And it's just the Emperor's got no clothes on. The invisible suit doesn't exist.
And you've despaired of the media telling it like you see it.
Well, I think that's true, yes. I think it's and despaired of the media telling the truth, basically. Because I think the media, you know, unwittingly ends up in the pocket of the politicians, and especially nowadays, and especially since 9/11, everybody's so afraid of doing the wrong thing, saying the wrong thing, and being held to account that it's very difficult for people to actually challenge things. It's a very old technique. I mean, you mentioned my medieval stuff. Well, in Who Murdered Chaucer, the book on the murder of Chaucer.
Yes.
We talk about what happened after the Henry IV usurps the throne of Richard II. So he murders Richard II. He steals the throne. It's a dishonorable act. He's not a popular person, Henry IV. Mm. His Archbishop of Canterbury, of course, in those days the church was very political, the Archbishop realizes that to get people behind him, they've got to have an enemy. So he declares a war on heresy. And it's exactly the same technique. By declaring a war on heresy, which he literally does, he can then make up the enemy. He can make everybody scared, and you can say, "Oh, heresy is the big problem. We've got to stop these heretics, otherwise they're going to destroy the world." And you create a climate of fear. You create a climate in which you can take away people's civil liberties, and you can introduce draconian measures, which is what they then did in the first part of the 15th century. And it's sort of history just repeats itself, really.
First part of the 15th century and first part of the 21st, in your view. I mean, clearly, you are seeing things just from the opposite side of the looking glass from the way they are officially described, and vigorously so. But at the same time, Terry Jones, with that Monty Python humor still on board, I'm looking down your list of essay headlines here. I mean, they're angry, they're bitter. They're funny. Osama looks haggard. Bombing for a safer world. I'm losing patience with my neighbors, Mr. Bush. How to bomb and save money. Why shouldn't Bush kill? And of course, the great one, it really isn't torture. I've had the kind of eye-opening chuckle and intake of breath from getting to read these. But of course, our listeners, most of them, will not have yet. Terry Jones, I wish you'd take us for a little tour at a kind of Monty Python level where you let the humor flow in as well through the way you see things. And what's jumped out at you in these recent years about how things are presented?
Well, I think it was really like immediately after 9/11, what really got me going was that both our great leaders, Tony Blair and George Bush, they both announced that they were going to take actions that seemed to be so obviously designed to have the opposite result of what they said they were going to do. Like, for example, immediately after 9/11, George Bush said exactly the right thing. He said, well, we have to catch the evil perpetrators of this evil crime. But now, to catch the perpetrators of a crime, you need to get the FBI involved, you need the police, you need to work secretly, you need to catch them red-handed, you need to be speedy. What you don't do is announce how long you're going to give the people you're looking for. We're going to give you 2 months, all right? And then you say, where are you going to look for them? We're going to look for you in Afghanistan. You've got to Afghanistan. And then you say, what are you going to do? We're going to bomb you, all right? I mean, at the end of 2 months, there's not a single evil perpetrator of an evil crime left in Afghanistan, I wouldn't have thought. So, you know, it's like nonsense. What a silly way of going about things. It was a hideous crime. It should have been treated as a crime. What you don't do is elevate somebody like Osama bin Laden into a hero, which is what you do by declaring war. You know, it's the United States against Osama bin Laden. You put him up on a pedestal.
And I have to say, I just saw on the wires, just before sitting down to speak with you, Terry Jones, a new wire story out, Flash. The United States is now running Osama wanted television ads on TV in Pakistan at the beginning of 2005.
That'll be a great help. Yes. It's like playing hide and seek, isn't it? I'm going to count up to 100, right. All right, and then we're going to come and look for you.
Right.
We're coming now. We're going to look for you.
And then you go after the kind of reading of tea leaves that the West or the United States used to say it had Osama on the run. In your essay, Osama looks haggard.
Well, it was a very odd thing. You suddenly found this is where you get the press all following line. They all come out with the same story, and all the press were saying Osama's looking haggard, and every newspaper in England said that. And obviously it was in some handout from government handout, and it was as if this was some great success, you know. The bombing of Afghanistan or whatever they'd done by then, they actually got he's looking haggard, so you know, if we keep going at this and bomb a few more places, we might wipe the smile off his face.
I notice I haven't heard much about it since he's begun looking rather spunky, healthy lately.
No, that's right.
And of course then you go straight at the whole idea of a war on terrorism, which you say, of course, this is an abstract noun. It's very hard for abstract nouns to surrender.
Well, this is true, actually. I mean, it's like an abstract noun can't surrender. How do you know when you've won? I mean, when you've got it struck from the Oxford English Dictionary or something. I think it's the first time in history where our great leaders have declared a war in which we don't know how we're going to win it. There's no way of knowing how you win it. And we don't know who the enemy is. We have no idea who the enemy is. And it's nonsense. You can't possibly fight a war like that. It's not a war. If you started a criminal investigation, that's fine. But to actually announce a war, it's just an empty political gesture.
A war on an abstract noun. And I want to ask you about that. But it is funny the way you go at it. You say it's about as meaningful as saying we shall annihilate mockery or we shall deride persiflage. But then, and seriously here, Terry, you remind us that the Second World War was fought also against an abstract noun, fascism. And we didn't laugh at that.
No, because I think fascism, I mean, they were the fascists. I mean, when you said fascism, you meant the fascists.
So what's the difference? Is a terrorist not a terrorist?
Well, yes, the big difference is that a terrorist isn't a terrorist until he's committed an action. And that's the real problem that you've got with the war on terror. It's like saying, I'm going to declare war on murder. You say, I would like, you know, it's a laudable thing to eliminate murder from the world, but how can you do it? How do you have to find out who's going to commit the next murder. How do you know? Now, the fascists, you knew who the fascists were, and you knew what they were doing. And they were there, and you could, there were two sides.
I mean, I guess some of them used the name right in the names of their political parties. The Italians were fairly proudly fascist.
Yeah, exactly, absolutely. It actually comes from fasces, which is the Latin for that bundle of rods that the Romans had as the symbol of the empire, when they were the sort of rods for beating people with, and that was where fascism comes from.
So here you are, and you're employing your fabled skills at humor, but also a really high dudgeon, deep anger at the same time. How does that feel?
Well, I do get fed up with it, to tell the truth, Tom. I feel my voice is sort of, it's the same tone going on, this sort of outrage. I get so cross. I didn't write these things, but I get really cross about what's going on. And I feel it's like a one note, and I kind of feel that I can't keep on doing it. Otherwise, I'll just explode, you know. Put me somewhere useful where I can explode usefully.
It takes me back to the life of Brian and the bloke sitting at the bottom of the hill listening to Jesus on the Mount who can't quite hear. What did he say? Blessed are the cheesemakers. Now Terry Jones sits at the bottom of the media mountain and listens to everything that's coming down on the war on terror, and he doesn't like it. He's joined us from London tonight. We'll have a lot more fun with this founder of the Monty Python Flying Circus. His new book is Terry Jones's War on the War on Terror, Observations and Denunciations by a Founding Member of Monty Python. Terry Jones, stand by in London. We have to take a short break. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
We're Knights of the Round Table. Our show's on war. Stay stable. So many times we've given rhymes that are quite unsingable. We're all combating terror, we sing from the diaphragm.
I have to push the pram along.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Terry Jones, a founding member of Monty Python. You remember all the movies, all the great jokes, all the great stories, Life of Brian, Monty Python, and the meaning of life and all the rest. He is out with a new book. It's a collection of essays he's written since 9/11. They're funny and they are angry. It's called Terry Jones's War on the War on Terror. He does not see this war the way the official line would describe it and the way he says most of the media describes it. Terry Jones, you've got here a third essay out. It's entitled, A Bag Over the Head is Worth Two for George Bush. This is from January 2002. So I note that your outrage started pretty early on. And in this case, it's kind of kicked off by a photograph that you saw in the New York Times. It shows a couple of U.S.
back
soldiers.
Back of a lorry, actually.
Back of a truck.
In the back of a lorry, and the U.S. Marines are guarding them. And the story was about the U.S. Marines going somewhere else. And there was nothing about the fact that they had these captives. And what got me about the picture was that the captives have got bags over their head with sellotape over them.
Yeah, just to describe it, a couple of Marines lounging with their machine guns.
Yeah.
And in half shadow behind them, a kind of uncountable number of captives with the bags over their heads. I wish you'd read a little bit from that essay, Terry Jones.
Okay. The story that accompanied the picture described how soldiers from the 101st Airborne Division had been ordered to relieve the U.S. Marine Corps in southern Afghanistan, paving the way for long-term military presence in the country. Photo also appeared in the Times here, but neither newspaper mentioned the part of the photo that got me so excited as president of the Humane Society for putting bags over suspects' heads. The photograph clearly showed that the prisoners suspected of belonging to Al-Qaeda had their arms pinioned behind them and had bags over their heads secured with metallic tape. Well, we in HSPBOSH have been trying for years to get more armies to put bags over the heads of anyone they suspect of anything. For one thing, the placing of a bag over the heads of suspects protects those of us who are not involved from unpleasant feelings of sympathy for the prisoners. There's nothing more offensive to ordinary law-abiding newspaper readers than seeing rows of sorry-looking peasants being herded into the backs of cattle trucks by our boys in the army. The prisoners often look frightened, dejected, and hungry. And how can anyone eat a decent full breakfast over photos like that? Once a bag has been firmly placed over their heads, however, it's impossible to feel anything much for them. They cease to be human beings, and as such make no unreasonable calls upon our emotions. The placing of bags over the suspects' heads also has another highly desirable effect. It instantly makes them all look guilty. One cannot see a man with a bag over his head without feeling that he must have deserved it, and that anything he's got coming to him is only what he ought to expect. The same probably goes for the person with a bag over his head. I've never had it done to me personally, you understand, but I believe the effect is very disorientating. A prisoner with a bag over his head ceases to feel human as well as look it, and the deprivation of sight and smell and balance encourages him to expect the worst. And this, of course, brings us to the economic argument for putting heads in bags. Once a suspect has been bound, had the bag placed over his head, and been driven around in the back of a cattle truck for a bit, he'll usually confess to anything. This saves a lot of time, effort, and most importantly, money in trying to sort out terrorists from ordinary blokes whom the army has rounded up because they had unpleasant beards and bad haircuts.
Terry Jones of Monty Python fame, reading from his essay, A Bag Over the Head, is worth two for George Bush. It's in his new book, Terry Jones's War, On the War on Terror. And there you go. You put that Monty Python sensibility to work on the War on Terror, and it's funny, but it's deeply, deeply angry. How have these essays and your sensibility in them been received in the UK?
The book hasn't been published over here, actually.
But the essays just, all have, right? I mean, in The Guardian.
Yeah, the essays most of them were published in The Guardian, and I was writing for The Observer. But The Observer went rather pro the war, actually, and I gradually found that I'd write these little pieces, and they'd say, "Oh, we love your new piece, Terry," and then about sort of just the day before it's about to be being published, they'd say, "Oh, terribly sorry, there's some more important news. Prince Diana's butlers just made an announcement. We'll have to print that instead." And I found I was getting bounced, so they only got published in The Observer and the electronic version.
But I must say, I ask because this kind of satire about the war is remarkably rare. Not at all unheard of, but remarkably rare in the U.S. And I wonder if you are sticking out like a sore thumb in the U.K. or if this is fairly standard mockery of Blair Bush and the war on terror.
I think it's probably more standard over here than it. Yeah, I don't know what's happening in the States, but I suspect there's a lot of people who agree with it. But maybe there's a lot of people who don't say it. You know, people are putting their... You know, I've heard of academics who have spoken out against it and have lost their jobs. Sorry, we have to take your job away from you. We've just suddenly run out of funding. There's an awful lot of pressure, I think, in the States coming from the Bush administration. Over here, it's not quite so blatant at the moment. There is a lot of pressure. The BBC has been whipped into line. So there is pressure there, but there's still quite a lot of criticism. And, you know, I mean, for goodness sake, before the invasion, there were a lot of people on the streets. I mean, we had 2 million people in London. It was the biggest demonstration we've ever had in the city. It's a lot of people, that is, to get 2 million people on the streets. That's not an inconsiderable number of people. And there's a lot of outrage about it. The trouble is, it's the language, you see, because the politicians just keep going on. They keep ignoring the criticisms. They never answer the real criticisms. They always answer other criticisms that one isn't making. They never answer the real criticism.
So what's the real criticism, Terry?
Well, if the criticism that you're not making the world safer place from terrorism. You're actually creating terrorists. Even Blair's Foreign Office told him this, that would happen. They said, you're going to create more terrorists if you go and bomb Iraq. The fact that Iraq, Saddam Hussein, had nothing to do with 9/11. The fact that George Bush, or the people behind George Bush, Rumsfeld, Cheney, Pearl, Paul Wolfowitz, they were planning to invade Iraq from years before. We know from their own account, we know from at least September 2000, the year before Bush got into power, they were planning to invade Iraq. And they say, I don't know whether your listeners know the Project for the New American Century.
It's kind of neocon group in Washington.
That's right, yes. It was formed by, Pearl Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, they were all involved in it, William Crystal, Robert Kaplan. And it's basically a think tank, really, right-wing think tank, neocon think tank.
And you're very head up about this September 2000 essay, the one entitled Rebuilding America's Defenses.
That's the one, yes, exactly. And in that essay, so this is not me making this up. This is something you can go and look at the website. It's what they were publishing and saying, you know, in all honesty, what they intended to do when they got into power. And they say in it, and this is a quote from Rebuilding American Defenses from September 2000, they said, and this is something to which Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Perle were signatories to this report. They say, the United States has for decades sought to play a more permanent role in Gulf regional security. While the unresolved conflict with Iraq provides the immediate justification, the need for a substantial American force presence in the Gulf transcends the issue of the regime of Saddam Hussein. Yeah, so Saddam Hussein is an excuse to establish an American force presence, as they call it, in the Gulf. So it was their policy. That's what they were going to go into Iraq, whatever happened, 9/11 or whatever. And 9/11 just provided an excuse.
You come at all of this with both guns blazing. You say, talking about the early stage of that conflict, I guess, the Iraq War was simply one country with a few hangers-on dropping a lot of bombs on another country after it had sent in teams of inspectors to make sure that the country it was bombing didn't have any weapons to fight back with. You write, Terry Jones, I can't think of any war, quote-unquote, in history that has been conducted on a more cowardly basis. We only call it a war because that's what George Bush and Tony Blair call it. But I have to ask you, do you think there's no conflict going on here? How do you describe...
I think there's a war going on now, but now they don't call it a war. You see, this is where the semantics, where the language comes into it. It was a war when US and the UK were just going in and bombing people because they knew they didn't have any defenses.
Yeah, but you're still on the case about language. You say that when Washington talks about rebels and terrorists in Iraq... you're offended again. You say, we didn't call the French resistance rebels and terrorists. Are you equating what's going on in Iraq with French resistance to the Nazis in World War II?
Well, I think exactly it. I mean, I think that's absolutely it. They have an invading army, which, according to the United Nations, is illegal. It shouldn't be there. And it's occupying their country. And don't forget that the US and the UK, between them, we've killed... probably almost as many Iraqis as people were killed in the tsunami disaster. Now, the tsunami disaster in the Indian Ocean, that was one of the biggest natural catastrophes in recorded history. And yet we're talking about the same kind of numbers of people. Over 100,000 people.
Citing this John Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health estimate of 100,000 killed
in
Iraq.
Exactly.
Now that's been disputed, but you're saying why dispute it? And of course, at one point, the tsunami had killed around 100,000. Now it's much higher than that.
Yes, exactly.
But you wrote recently in The Guardian again, I'm bewildered by the world reaction to the tsunami tragedy. And the point you're making there is...
well, it's really just that it's the same numbers of people we're talking about. At that point, when I wrote that essay, we thought it was 150,000. And that's the same kind of number that John Hopkins is really talking about being killed in the invasion of Iraq. So, you know, it's a huge number of people. This is more people than were killed by German bombing raids in the Second World War in England. This is twice as many, three times as many.
I want to get to the heart of this. You're a scholar of the Crusades. You've written a lot about the Crusades. You're looking seriously at this. You say it's not war. They're not rebels. They're not terrorists. But do you not see a conflict playing out in the world today? And if you do, how would you describe it?
Well, I think a lot of it comes from what the West is doing to in Israel and the support that the West has been giving the Sharons of this world in their conflict with the Palestinians and the repression of the Palestinians. That's what a lot of the protest and the terrorism is about.
So you don't take literally the Islamists' stated desire to spread Islam fundamentalist Islam.
Historically, Islam has not been an evangelical religion. Christianity has been evangelical.
Well, but the image is that Islam, the religion, spread by the sword.
This was in the first 50 years, 100 years of Islam. This is true. Since then, Islam became very... it wasn't a proselytizing religion. In the 14th century, it wasn't. They coexisted very peaceably. I mean, for goodness sake, they worship the same God. Jesus Christ is a saint, is a revered figure in Islam. There's not these big differences at all in the two religions, and the two religions can live, can coexist side by side quite peaceably, and they did for hundreds and hundreds of years.
You know, but so you say boils down to Israel, kind of simple as that. You know, I'm sure you do, in the United States, people who reduce the argument to that are often tagged anti-Semitic.
Why? Why? I'm not being anti-Semitic. Just because I dislike Sharon and think he's a criminal, a war criminal, that doesn't make me anti-Semitic. If I said all Jews were war criminals, yes, that would be anti-Semitic. But I don't say that because I don't believe it. It isn't true. But a lot of my best friends are Jews. I'm a great fan of the Jewish way of life, as a matter of fact. I wish I was Jewish.
I'm not making the charge. I'm just passing on. Yeah. It's often.
No, I mean, I was saying it's a typical thing. It's a way. This is the kind of way that the neocons and the right wing pervert all the arguments against them. They divert the argument not to what you're actually saying, i.e., we don't like the regime that is running Israel at the moment. And let me tell. And you know, there are a lot of Israelis who don't like the regime. And then to say that's anti-Semitic, I mean, it's nonsense. You know, it's hardly worth.
Near the end of the life of Brian, of course, Brian is born next to Jesus and mistaken for a savior, and spends his life trying to kind of get away for this. And he exhorts his motley band of followers. He says, "You've all got to think for yourselves. We've all got to think for ourselves. If people were doing that, what solution to the kind of tensions that are running so high in the world right now do you think they'd come to?"
Well, I think, you know, thinking of yourself is a very laudable thing and things that we have to do. But I think also it's very difficult to think for yourself unless you have the evidence to go on. You have unless you know what is going on. And unfortunately, I don't think in the mainstream press and television you ever hear what is really going on, because it's all filtered through this. Through the vocabulary of the politics of the day. So, for example, we hear about rebels in Iraq attacking security forces. You could read that another way, say loyal resistance fighters attack the invading army or attack the Quislings, because that's what they regard the Iraqis who are working with the Americans and the British.
But only today, Shiites all over Iraq, around Baghdad, have been blown up in their significant numbers by somebody. Are those freedom fighters blowing up Shiites on their way to mosque?
It's very complicated. I don't know what, there's different things. You've got, what you've unleashed in there now is other things. You've unleashed a sort of situation a bit like Ireland, where you've got Protestants and Catholics against each other, and long simmering resentments have been unleashed. So that's, I don't support anybody blowing people up. But when you've got the so-called security forces, i.e. Iraqis who have joined the American side, they know that they're regarded as Quislings and collaborators. And unfortunately, the poor guys, I'm sure they don't want to do it, but they've got no choice because there's no other work for them. I mean, I think one of the big things that the Americans did when they went in was they disbanded the army and made everybody out of work, which is a stupid thing to do.
You illuminate many things in these essays by dropping them into a different context. In February 2002, you were writing Bombing for a Safer World, and you began there saying, to prevent terrorism by dropping bombs on Iraq is such an obvious idea that I can't think why no one has thought of it before. It's so simple. If only the UK had done something similar in Northern Ireland. And then you imagine what?
Well, it's like you extrapolate. You apply what is going on now to that situation. You say, well, we'd have to look for who are supporting the IRA. Well, there's a lot of people in America sending money to the IRA, so I think we should go and bomb Philadelphia, and we should bomb anywhere where there's Irish supporters in America. And also we should bomb Liverpool, and we should bomb... you end up bombing everywhere. I mean, it's like, it's such a nonsensical thing. You can't do it, and that's not the way to deal with terrorism.
Where do you think this is all headed, Terry Jones?
Well, I think it's very disastrous. I think it's very black lookout on the world, because I think the regime that you have in power in America at the moment, backed up by this sycophantic government in England, you have a regime that really wants war. I think the Rumsfelds and the Cheneys of this world actually want war. They glory in it. They look forward to it. It's not something to be avoided. And they state in the Project for the New American Century that the time for diplomacy is past. Diplomacy belongs to the old world, the old out-of-date world. In the new Kantian realism, the only thing that counts is force.
Terry Jones, stand by in London. We've got to take a short break. We'll be right back with more. Terry Jones, founding member of Monty Python. Now, yes, he's still funny, but he's angry as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
There's nothing nature couldn't teach about the rising of the wrist. Socrates himself was permanently pissed. John Stuart Mill on his own free will, on hot box, shiny was particularly ill. Quite on his side, he could stick it away. Half a pint of whiskey every day. Aristotle was a backer for the bottle. Hobbes was fond of his dram. And Rennie Descartes was a drunken fart. I drink, therefore I am. Yes, Socrates himself is particularly missed. A lovely little thinker by the bugger when he's pissed.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Terry Jones, a founding member of Monty Python. He's been making humor for a long time. Also, a scholar of the Crusades in the medieval ages. He's got a new book out now called Terry Jones's War on the War on Terror. I want to get some perspective off of some of the work he's done before. He did a four-part series on the Crusades, and in it, Terry Jones told the story of what began as a holy mission to liberate Jerusalem and would become the largest mass migration in European history. Let's listen back to some tape from that. Terry Jones, stand by in London. You have to listen to yourself for a moment. Here, you talk about one of the intrinsic ironies of the Crusades being waged in the name of God.
Take a rich young warrior like Tancred de Hauteville. Even on a bad day, he would end up killing someone. If you could afford the right kit, there wasn't much chance of being killed yourself. And he was trained to destroy the weak. But Tancred's biographer recorded that this sensitive 17-year-old was very worried that God disapproved of killing people. This conflict of moral authorities was a recipe for psychological instability. We can all surely recognise in Tancred a classic example of the double-bind theory of schizophrenia. And knights had no teddy bears. No wonder they lashed out in a crisis.
Terry Jones in his 1995 production, Crusades. And Terry, there you go to work on the psychology, sort of highlighting the moral hazard, the moral price engaged in the Crusades. I hear you describing what's going on now as something like that, whatever George Bush may say, different driving motives, I'm sure. But do you see the U.S., the U.K. for that matter, with its rather significant involvement, having worked itself into that double bind that you described there, or not?
Yes, no, I think you certainly have. Actually, just listening to that clip, I just remembered that, of course, in the medieval world, you had to do penance for anybody you killed. For example, after the Battle of Hastings in 1066, when William the Conqueror invaded England, everybody on the battlefield who killed somebody had to do 40 days penance for everybody they killed, even in battle. So we worked out that William the Conqueror was probably responsible for so many deaths that he'd probably be still doing penance. He wouldn't be finished until 2052 or something.
It's not exactly that way now, 40 days penance per day.
It's not. I mean, nowadays, nobody thinks twice. It was war, so you just kill anybody you like.
And yet, those are human beings, the soldiers doing the killing being done on both sides. I mean, humans do remember when they've killed, most
that's
anyway.
Right. Yeah, that's right. I think, you know, I feel so sorry for the soldiers out there now who are witnessing all this horror and what they're going through, and they'll have it with them for the rest of their lives. They'll be psychologically scarred.
You go very hard on the torture that's emerged. I don't read as much about the beheadings. We can talk about that, but the torture by American soldiers and in some reports, I guess, at a lesser degree by British. And you had an essay last summer entitled "It Really Isn't Torture," where you again shift the setting and in that bring it home. I wish you'd read some of that for us.
So it's one of these things. If you just change the context and say the same things that Donald Rumsfeld, and it's really following on those memos that Gonzales wrote to Rumsfeld saying that, you know, you don't need to worry about this because torture isn't torture unless you actually, you're only doing it to hurt somebody. If you're doing it to extract information, then it isn't torture. So I wrote a piece called It Really Isn't Torture. And it goes like this. For some time now, I've been trying to find out where my son goes after choir practice. He simply refuses to tell me. He says it's no business of mine where he goes after choir practice, and it's a free country. Now, it may be a free country, but if people start going just anywhere they like after choir practice, goodness knows whether we'll have a country left to be free. I mean, he might be going to anarchist meetings or Islamic study groups. How do I know? The thing is, if people don't say where they're going after choir practice, this country is at risk. So I've been applying a certain amount of pressure on my son to tell me where he's going. To begin with, I simply put a bag over his head and chained him to a radiator. But did that persuade him? Does the Pope eat kosher? My wife had the gall to suggest that I might be going a bit too far, so I put a bag over her head and chained her to the radiator. But I still couldn't persuade my son to tell me where he goes after choir practice. I tried starving him, serving with only cold meals, and shaving off his facial hair, keeping him in stress positions, not turning his light off, playing loud music outside his cell door, all the usual stuff that any concerned parent will do to find out where their child is going after choir practice. But it was all to no avail. I hesitated to gravitate to harsher interrogation methods because, after all, he is my son. Then Donald Rumsfeld came to my rescue.
And there you digress to remind us of some of the technocratic definitions of what is and is not permissible, what is and is not torture. And then you drive this essay home. And here, I mean, so far it's kind of gently bouncing along. In the last couple of paragraphs, you take it to a plane American humorists seldom visit. I wish you'd give us your conclusion.
So I'm going to round up all the children in the neighborhood, chain them up, set dogs on them. I might accidentally kill one or two, but I won't have intended to. And perhaps I'll take some photos of my wife standing on the dead bodies, and then I'll show the photos to the other kids. And finally, perhaps I might get to find out where my son goes after choir practice. After all, I'll only be doing what the present U.S. administration has been condoning since 9/11.
That's pretty hot. That's pretty angry.
Well, I think it makes you angry when you find that you're, you know, we fought the Second World War. I've always thought that we, you know, we didn't condone torture. And that's what we're condemning Saddam Hussein for. We're saying he's an evil man because he killed people and he used torture. So where's the difference? We are now killing more people than Saddam Hussein ever killed in Iraq, and we are using torture. It's just mind-blowing. I have no concept how they get away with it.
So let me ask you that. Here we're talking across the Atlantic. George Bush will be visiting London soon. Next week we'll meet with Tony Blair. Tony Blair, the UK through him, have stood kind of shoulder to shoulder at the official level with the US. What's going on in the US-UK, I don't know, dialectic here that's mutually reinforcing this view, in your view, Terry Jones?
Well, I honestly don't know, Tom. To me, it's a great mystery. I mean, you know, when Tony Blair says, well, I'm going to support the U.S. and we're going to go in and attack Iraq because I want to make this country safe from terrorist attacks, and we know, as ordinary people, that he's going to lay us on the front line for terrorist attacks by doing that. The Foreign Office tells him that's exactly what's going to happen. You think, why on earth is he doing it? What's he got to gain out of it? Does he get a red carpet when he goes to Washington? He probably gets a nice signed Christmas card from George Bush. Mm. What else does he get out of it? I have no idea. The only thing I can possibly think is that if he didn't support the U.S. policies, the U.S. would just very quietly pull the plugs on the economy in this country. But I only a surmise. I have no evidence for that.
George Bush was reelected in November. Tony Blair will be facing his own election challenge this spring, most likely. Do you think, despite Terry Jones' anger, that Mr. Blair will end up back in power?
Unfortunately, Tom, I think he will, yes. I have a deep suspicion that my anger will not be enough to prevail against him.
But does that mean that you're an outrider in British opinion? Are you a marginal guy now, Mr. Monty Python?
There's a lot of people who agree with what I'm saying, and a lot of people who think the same way. The trouble is, in this country, we have no opposition. There is nobody else. There's nobody there. There's no dialogue. And it's one of the problems with democracy, that you cannot have democracy unless you have a choice. And where you don't have a choice, there is no democracy. It's just a charade we're going through. And it's one of the sad things that democracy, it seems to me, is no longer working in either England or America. I think it's slightly better in America. At least you have a choice there. But over here, we don't have an opposition. It's a very sad state of affairs.
Terry Jones, it's been a very interesting hour. You're there in London. I can't let you go without a little Monty Python fun. Fox hunting outlawed today in the UK. Has it got you very upset?
Oh, yes, right. It did. I cannot understand why people are so outraged about fox hunting. So if they want to get outraged about something, they should be outraged about, you know, the farming techniques and the way we slaughter our animals.
And your prince is marrying Camilla. Are you jealous?
I'm off Camilla.
Yeah, well, could be. All right. You caught me. Terry Jones, we're out of time. It's been great talking with you. We're so grateful to you for being with us.
Okay, take care.
Terry Jones, founding member of Monty Python. His new book is Terry Jones's War on the War on Terror, Observations and Denunciations by a Founding Member of Monty Python. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps. Just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. Hey.
Always look on the bright side of life.
Come on.
Always look on the bright side of life.
In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point News analyst Jack Beattie. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
I appreciate your confidence in choosing me for what will no doubt be the most challenging assignment I have undertaken in more than 40 years of government service.
John Negroponte is a very controversial figure, and I don't think that's a good idea for this job, which is brand new and has to work with all kinds of different agencies.
The ayes are 98, the nays are 0, and the nomination is confirmed.
The one thing that distinguishes this department is the spirit of the people who serve within it and the goodwill and prayers of everybody in the American public who wishes us the best.
Our job at FTA and your job in the advisory group is to balance risk and benefits on a population basis for the nation as a whole.
The class action mechanism is the best, and that's why big business wants to get rid of it or to limit it severely. And that's what this bill does.
I like hockey, but I think they're all spoiled little brats, so I'm not interested in watching if they don't want to play.
You know, for me, it was a bittersweet night in one sense, because the pain of losing Ray Charles is those of us who knew him and who loved him. You know, we will never forget that pain.
They thought the treaty made sense. I didn't. And neither did the United States Senate when it rejected the Kyoto concept 95-0.
We worry about sea levels. We worry about the preservation of the Gulf Stream, about the increase in drought and flood frequencies. And you're getting stronger and stronger courage among the scientific community to say that these issues are real.
The winning Shiite coalition has won 140 of the 275 seats in the National Assembly, so just over a clear majority of that. 75 seats have gone to the Kurdish alliance and 40 seats have gone to the party of Ayad Alawi.
It is a car bomb in the crater. It's 15 foot deep. There are many cars burning. I counted 22, and quite a lot of dead people. I saw a dead woman in a taxi. I saw several bodies on fire.
There's no doubt that Syria is a big problem, and I do think that the recall of the ambassador is a strong signal, and as I said, while Lebanon was the proximate cause, this has been growing for some time.
Nobody's going to take this away from us. You know, Lebanon was really, really starting to rise. We cannot stand anymore and just say, we will accept this. It's enough. We've had enough.
And there's a week. President Bush nominates John Negroponte to be the new U.S. intelligence czar over all 15 American intelligence agencies. Former CIA head Stansfield Turner objects. Michael Chertoff is confirmed as Secretary of Homeland Security. The FDA holds hearings on the safety of Vioxx and other COX-2 inhibitors. Today, the panel says the pain relievers should be allowed to remain on the market. President Bush signs into law legislation limiting class action lawsuits. The National Hockey League officially cancels the 2005 season. Ray Charles posthumously wins 8 Grammys for his album Genius Loves Company. The Kyoto Protocol goes into effect without the United States. Iraq's election results are formally certified. And former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri is assassinated in Beirut. A lot going on many fronts there this week, Jack.
Yes, and a framing this week of two events that I think speak to one of the theses about American politics today. You know, we've had Tom Frank, the author of What's the Matter with Kansas, on our show. And basically he argues there that the Republicans talk the religious issue, but they really delivered a big business. And this week, I think we saw something like that. The week began with the former deputy director of the faith-based initiative in the White House, David Koo, writing a piece in BeliefNet, a more in sorrow than an anger piece, decrying what he called minimal commitment from the White House to what President Bush had called one of the most important initiatives of his administration and knee-jerk Democratic opposition.
He pointed out that
this is the faith-based initiatives. And he points out that, well, among other things, that the president had promised that he $6 billion was going to go into tax incentives that would generate charitable giving. Well, that went out to make room for tax cuts on the estate tax. He points out that Bush basically promised $6.8 billion for all sorts of programs for at-risk youth, children of prisoners, things like that. He only spent $500 million. He points out that the faith-based compassion fund, which was supposed to get $200 million, only got $100 million, and on and on. And as I say, he blames, he says the president had commitment to it, his staff didn't, and they didn't care, as he put it, about this poor people stuff.
So class action lawsuits reined in, bankruptcy, tougher bankruptcy laws on the way. That is, they're making the case, or are you, feeding business, not necessarily the religious right?
Well, that seems to be what happened here, at least this is at least on the faith-based initiative front. But Kuo says that... you know, this didn't really matter to Reverend Dobson and some of these people. They took Bush's profession, his interest in faith-based initiatives, as enough, and that they weren't really spending any money on it, that they weren't doing much, that they weren't pushing it against the Democrats, for example, and Republicans. That didn't seem to bother them.
And let us not forget that social values issues remain to be dealt with. Court appointments of Rehnquist is not sitting as the Supreme Court goes back in session. It's not as though the religious rights agenda is finished.
Oh, by no means. By no means. But this does show, it seems to me, delivering for big business, and that's what elections are about. So there's no mystery that the Republicans are more favorable toward big business than the Democrats. And sort of talking the talk on faith-based efforts.
And what else catches your eye this week, Jack?
Oh, I think we're going to hear more about the James Guckert scandal at the White House. It turns out he knew 4 hours in advance about President Bush's speech that he was going to attack Iraq. How did he know? Who told him?
Suggestion being maybe he was the planted suggestion. He denies it. Everybody denies it. But it's not quite a resolved issue.
We just don't know. Republicans fear there's more to come.
Jack, thanks for being with us tonight. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio. Support for